Dublin, writes John Banville, is an incomprehensibly graphomane capital, less city than town, less town than village, less village than inkpot. Dublin, a writer city, investigates the extent to which the capital has not only been reflected by, but created by its authors, poets and dramatists. This author, Chris Morrish, is the inaugural Seamusini Professor of Irish Writing. He's with me in studio this evening. And yes, even when he writes a short sentence, John Banville has to send us off to the dictionary to find out what what a graphomane is.
Yeah.
But he's kind of capturing in that sentence, you know, Dublin almost was created out of an inkpot. It is as much a creation by a set of writers as it was the melting pot that brought a set of writers together. That's basically what your book's about, Chris.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I came to Dublin in the 1980s, and I suppose the gap between what Dublin looked like and the kind of allure of the place, the magic of the place.
The Dublin that you had read about.
Yeah, the Dublin I'd read about was particularly at that point, was quite remarkable. You know, I mean, I lived on Westland Row, and you looked at Westland Row, and it was a fairly innocuous-looking street.
Yeah, but let's actually, what's extraordinary is, you gave that Westland Row address to the cab driver when you arrived here in 1985. And as you were giving him that Westland Row address, it suddenly struck you all of the connections that you had from your reading to that address.
I mean, I was going to 15 Westland Row. I realised that Oscar Wilde had been born six doors down at 21, that if I went to one end of the street, which I did more or less as soon as I arrived, looking for a chemist shop, there's Sweeney's Chemist Shop, which is where Leopold Bloom buys lemon soap from Molly Bloom. It's kitty corner to Finn's Hotel, where, of course, Joyce goes on his first walkabout with Nora Barnacle. Around the corner is the office where Samuel Beckett worked in his father's office on Clare Street. Go to the other end of the street, look diagonally across Pierce Street. There is what was the ancient concert rooms, which is where the first production of the Irish Literary Theatre took place in 1899. It becomes the Abbey. All this was within the first few minutes. Mm. And it was almost like there was another city that was invisible if you didn't know the literature, that was sitting on top of the real city.
Yeah, and that's what you do. You start mapping out in the book, you map out this unseen city. But if you can't see the place, it's hard to make a map.
Yes, it is. And I suppose that's what the book tries to do. That once you know the story, you never walk by a place again and not see what's there. I mean, last night, Roddy Doyle was launching the book and he was saying how he has a place where he works on Dame Street, and he goes to a little diner up on Lord Edward Street, Rosie's. And he said, I hadn't realized the first theatre in Dublin was right there opposite St. Werburgh's Church in the 1630s. And he said, I will never again go into the diner without knowing that there was a theatre here on this site. And once you know it, the city becomes a different place.
And that idea, I mean, you quote Elizabeth Bowen in the book as well about the idea that she talks about emotional memory here has so much power that the past and the present seem to be lived simultaneously. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think what you're saying is the actual and the fictional, because most of these creations that you're talking about are totally fictional. The actual and the fictional are living side by side.
I think that's right. And I think that's one of the things that makes Dublin so special, is that sense that the past and the present co-inhabit the same space. And I mean, Elizabeth Bowen, she's just so good at capturing things absolutely precisely. And I think one of the reasons for that, when she was writing that in the 1940s, was that Dublin as a city had, you know, a century and a half of underdevelopment at that point. So where other cities, you know, tear down, build up, tear down, build up, in Dublin, the tearing down didn't happen to the same extent. So the Georgian city was there. The Victorian city was there. There were traces of the medieval city were still there. The modern city was there. So all the bits of the city kind of sat side by side. So you could see the physical traces of the city, and therefore the memories kind of, you know, have something to hang on to.
And the writers, in many ways, across the generations, they're like, you know, if you visit any city in Italy, you're going to be shown, you'll go inside a building and you'll see right down the layers of the building underneath from different periods in time, different architectural periods. In terms of writers here, you get the same thing. One writer almost mapped on top of another in a different chronological period.
And that's what I wanted to do with the book. I didn't want to write a history that just, you know, started at the year, some beginning point and went up to the present. I wanted to do a book that was organized spatially, so that if you took a street and you say you took a street, say, somewhere in the Liberties, and you have Jonathan Swift there in the 18th century, you have James Clarence Mangan in those same streets in the 19th century, or the great Gothic writer Charles Maturin there in the 19th century. And then you layer on top of that, say, a Tana French crime novel set there in the 21st century. And it's like all those things exist side by side. So I almost imagine sort of the characters and the authors talking to one another, co-inhabiting the streets.
Yeah, because to think that you could have Tana French and Jonathan Swift sitting right beside each other it's quite an exciting prospect.
It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Now, if the minute we talk about maps of Dublin and writers creating a city, the first person that's going to come to mind is Joyce. You can't walk the streets of Dublin without thinking of Joyce, of course, because that's what he made Leopold Bloom do in Ulysses. He made him walk the streets of Dublin. Explain the term Bagatonia to me.
Yeah, it's a sort of piece of imaginary geography. Mm. It generally refers to that sort of area around Baggot Street Bridge, Parsons Bookshop, Searson's Pub, that area in around there, because so many writers lived there in the 1940s and 50s. I mean, John Banville is quite witty on this as to what constitutes Bagatonia and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. That, you know, Percy Place, at one end of it, the leafy end is Bagatonia, and the other end is Bagatonia, but the middle is definitely not. It's just, you know, such are the mysterious ways of cities. But it was an area in which a tremendous number of writers lived. Patrick Kavanagh, most famously, lived in, you know, Pembroke Road, he lived in Wilton Place, he lived in Raglan Road. Brendan Behan lived in Herbert Street. John Montague lived just down from him. Dolman Press was around the corner. The Pike Theatre was there. The Lantern Theatre was there. And then, of course, you had O'Donoghue's Pub, and the Dubliners are starting up by the time you get to the 60s. So you had this quite small little nest of streets, and you could walk around that area today on a Sunday morning and hardly see a soul. Mm. That was just rich in literary culture and people living there.
You mentioned the Kavanagh, and obviously we immediately think of the canals when it comes to Kavanagh as well. But I have a clip here of Kavanagh himself, because it brings up, I think, another idea that you express quite strongly in the book regarding the Colchies and the Jack Eanes. Not terms that you use, they're my terms. Let's have a listen to Paddy Kavanagh.
If ever you go to Dublin town in 100 years or so, inquire for me in Baggot Street and what he was like to know. Oh, he was a queer one, fal dal the dido. He was a queer one, I tell you. My great-grandmother knew him well. He asked her to come and call on him in his flat, and she giggled at the thought of a young girl's lovely fall. Oh, he was dangerous, fal dal the dido. He was dangerous, I tell you. On Pembroke Road, look out for my ghost, dishevelled with shoes untied, playing through the railings with little children, whose children have long since died. Oh, he was a nice man, fal dal the dido. He was a nice man, I tell you. Go into a pub and listen well, if my voice still echoes there. Ask the men what their grandfathers thought, and to tell them to answer fair. Oh, he was eccentric, fal dal the dido. He was eccentric, I tell you.
That's Paddy Kavanagh, and if ever you go to Dublin town, from the RTE archives. That's an extraordinary little bit of singing from Kavanagh there, isn't it, Chris Morrish?
Yeah, it is an extraordinary piece of meaning. And Kavanagh's part of that generation that when we think of a literary Dublin, this is what we think of, I think. There's a lot, is that world of McDade's Pub, people, Kavanagh, Brendan Behan, Flann O'Brien, there's others around that area. And it was a real literary scene, but it was a destructive one as well. You know, that it was one that was really centered around drink. It was centered around a lot of personal animosities. They're all writers who produce great work. But there's also a real struggle there as well, and I think a real sadness about it. And some of it is about being displaced, I think.
Yeah, because I think you give us this idea of, you know, this, there's always a duality when it comes to Dublin in many ways. The you know, that kind of wonderful place that nurtured all these writers, but yet had a destructive capacity within it as well. Yeah. A city, as you put it, that is full of country people. And of course, Paddy Kavanagh fits into that perfectly.
Absolutely. And his best work comes when he is able to reconcile those two things. When he starts to write those sonnets about the Grand Canal, the Grand Canal Bank, and he takes a perfectly ordinary piece of the city, just a canal lock, and he invests it with all the beauty and all the peace and all the calm of the pastoral. So in the center of the city, it's like he finds this little perfect place. And then in the middle of it, you know, all around that, you have Paddy Kavanagh, you know, producing chaos in the kind of the song you hear there, where he's prodding everybody in sight and, having a go. Yeah.
But the world that is described in that and the world that you've described in many ways, McDade's pub and all the rest, that's a quite male-centric type of world. But you're very, and from the outset, you are very keen and very clear to have a lot of female writers in here as well. Was there a kind of a parallel map, if you like, that wasn't as gender stuck as the male map?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that was fascinating as I start kind of unraveling this world, is we all know about that world in the 40s and the 50s around McDade's, and it was very, very male, you know, very testosterone driven. And then in the same streets, you had writers like Mary Lavin lived in Ladd Lane. You had Teresa Devey lived in Waterloo Road. You had Kate O'Brien would have, you know, been around the city. Elizabeth Bowen is, you know, the only writer actually born in Bagotonia at that time, really. Yeah. She was born in Herbert Place, you know, right on the canal. So you had a whole group of women, and they formed a society called the Irish Women's Writers Club. And they had monthly meetings, and they would meet in places like the Gresham or the Country House, Country Shop Restaurant, or the Shelburne, and they would have a dinner. And they were actually even able to act in political ways, in a kind of concerted way. There was an episode in which a postmistress had been dismissed in Wicklow, and they collectively acted and lobbied on her behalf. So all this was happening at the same time, in the same streets, but almost in a kind of parallel way.
Yeah, so it's like there are different maps
for
where you want to go in terms of the literature itself.
Yeah, even at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are certain places that you've mentioned, the Liberties and Jonathan Dean Swift and bring us right up to Tana French. What about the North Inner City? And of course, we're going to immediately think of Sean O'Casey. But Dorset Street is very, or Dorset Street, depending on your preference, is very interesting in this case.
Yeah, I mean, there must be something in the water in Dorset Street, because it's. I can't think of too many streets in the world that have produced a major playwright in three different centuries. So, you know, Richard Brinsley Sheridan, you know, was born there. His father, Thomas Sheridan, lived on the street when he was the manager of Smock Alley in the 18th century. Dion Boucicault, probably one of the most successful playwrights in the world in the 19th century, was born right up along there as well, not too far down. And then, of course, Sean O'Casey is born exactly into that same area in the 20th century. So in three different centuries, you get three major playwrights all born within a few minutes walk of each other.
You also find a map that can link us almost, you almost take us on a walk that links us Joyce into Beckett and across over the sea, over the bay to Seamus Heaney.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, you know, Heaney lived for many years happily in Strand Road. Where he lived was not actually very far from where Yeats was born. Mm. We tend to think of Yeats with Sligo and all over the place, but he was actually born there in South Dublin. You could down the coast a bit and you're at the Martello Tower where Joyce famously sets the opening of Ulysses and lived briefly. And then from there, you're looking across to Dunleary Pier. End of Dunleary Pier is the anemometer that Beckett uses in Crap's Last Tape, and which forms one of the key moments in his work. I mean, how many places in the world do you have three Nobel laureates and one who should have been all lined up
all
like
lined
that?
Up in that fashion. And I suppose we have a Seamus Heaney poem from the famous collected poems, the Lannan Foundation collected poems that are so beloved of people. This links in with what you're saying there, the poem In Illo Tempore. Just give us a lead into this, if you would, Chris.
Yeah, this is Heaney looking out on the Strand, looking out on Sandymount Strand. And what he is channeling here is the opening of the Proteus episode of Ulysses. where Stephen Dedalus looks out across Sandymouth Strand, and anybody knows that when the tide goes out, this is exactly what you feel. And he says, am I walking into eternity on Sandymouth Strand? And Heaney picks up that idea. The title in Latin basically means in that time, but it usually refers to the time before history.
The big missile splayed and dangled silky ribbons of emerald and purple and watery white. Intransitively, we would assist, confess, receive. The verbs assumed us. We adored. And we lifted our eyes to the nouns. Altar stone was dawn and monstrance noon. The word rubric itself a bloodshot sunset. Now I live by a famous strand where seabirds cry in the small hours like incredible souls. And even the range wall of the promenade that I pressed down on for conviction hardly tempts me to credit it.
That's Seamus Heaney and In Illo Tempore there. That's from Station Island, is the collection that's from, isn't it?
That is from Station Island, yeah. And there's another part of Station Island where Joyce imagines he's walking by the seawall on Sandymouth Strand, and Joyce is down there on the strand, and he kind of helps him up off the strand.
Heaney imagining that he's meeting Joyce there. You also use Joyce as a way, because you do look to the past in some ways, and you build these layers of writer upon writer, which keeps bringing me back to this idea of the foundations of a building and the different layers of architecture. There's a touch of that in there, but you find a way of looking forward, and you use Joyce to do that.
Yeah. I think Joyce provides us with a way of not just imagining the city, but imagining the way in which writers talk to one another. And I think this is a good example of that. One of the mysteries is, you know, how does Dublin keep producing so many good writers? And I think once you have a kind of critical mass of writers, writers begin to kind of play off one another. So, you know, here's Heaney knowing that he is living opposite the strand that Joyce has written about. And so that becomes something that Heaney writes about. And, you know, and you can see that kind of moving forward into the future as well, of writers continually playing off one another.
And Gabriel, I suppose, in The Dead, he kind of he looks into a new version. Is it, he's looking westward here?
He is, yeah. I mean, at the end of The Dead, there's that marvelous passage where Gabriel's looking across the west, or to the west of Ireland, you know, and snow is general over Ireland. And one of the things I asked myself was, good, why does Joyce set that episode in Usher's Island? You know, why there? And realized at the time he was writing that story, he was also giving lectures in Trieste about James Clarence Mangan. And he uses a phrase in the essay about Mangan that is very much like what he says in The Dead, where he says, no moment of exaltation is ever lost, this sense that it goes on and on. And Mangan was born about 100 yards away from Usher's Island.
From Usher's Island. Let's have a listen to, again, from the RTE Archives, famous rendition here of The Dead of James Joyce.
A few light taps upon the pane, hills falling softly general all over Ireland on his journey westward. Silver and dark pane, native din, was dissolving and dwindling. A few light taps upon the pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes, silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the Bog of Allen, and farther westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end, upon all the living and the dead.
Wonderful closing moments there. It's quite extraordinary, Chris Morris. I mean, it's even just to let that wash over you for no other reason than to listen to it. Perfectly acceptable. Now, we've been talking about your book, Dublin, A Writer's City, but this is a part of a series from Cambridge University Press, Imagining Cities.
That's right, yeah. I mean, this was the first one, and Cambridge University Press liked it so much they decided to do more. So the second book in the series, with kind of wonderful inattention to order, was launched last week, actually, New Orleans. Which is a fabulous book, and we have books commissioned on New York, London, and Cambridge itself.
Right,
and kind of more in the pipeline.
More in the pipeline for sure. Well, congratulations on the book. I know you had a lot of fun doing it. You were telling me, Chris, you'll be back in with us next week.
I will. Yes, Dublin Literary Award shortlist coming out next week.
Time of the year again.
Second
year every 2 years.
And we have six great books coming up.
Well, we'll find out more about that next week. But thanks. In the meantime, for being in with us today or tonight. Dublin, A Writer's City by Chris Morris, published by Cambridge University Press. It was launched last night, wasn't it? Yeah, it was launched, and that launched by Roddy Doyle.